Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Hello, welcome to another virtual program with Maine Historical Society. I'm Kathleen Newman. It is June 10th, 2021, and this is The Coming of the Invisible People with Bob Green. A native of Portland, Bob Green is a retired Associated Press journalist and a Maine historian. He has done extensive research into his own genealogy and discovered that he is at least the eighth generation of his family to be born in Cumberland County. Bob has taught Black History of Maine at Ollie, is a recent recipient of the Neil Allen Award, and is on the board of trustees of the Maine Historical Society. And he has been a great friend to MHS for a long time. And we're so happy that he could join us this evening. Thanks for being here, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you. I was 7 years old when my parents put me on a train in Kansas City so that I could visit my aunt, my father's sister, in Denver, Colorado. It was an all-night train ride. And although I was only seven, I felt like a grown-up because I was traveling alone. Years later, I realized that all of the porters on that Union Pacific train in 1943 were friends of my aunt. While I was patting myself on the back for being an adult, all of those Black porters were keeping an eye on this young man, making sure that I arrived safely in Denver and to my Aunt Bibi. Those Black men working on the railroads across America were a big reason why all passengers, like this little boy, were safe and sound and had all their wishes and demands filled during their journeys. The same was true on the sea. Black seamen were common on the vessels that traveled up and down the Atlantic and Caribbean coast or across the oceans to faraway lands. It was the perfect job for them if they were competent and enough were. Maine is now known as vacation land, and for the flood of tourists we complain about every summer. Unless, of course, we have a business that depends on those people from away. In the 1800s, however, Maine was a completely different animal. We're talking about a place where a majority of the country's shipping fleet was built. We're talking about a port, Portland, that during the age of sail was one day closer to Europe than Boston. You shipped through Portland if you wanted to get it there quickly. We're talking about a state that in 1860 had 8 electoral votes, twice as many as today. We're talking about a state that provided Abraham Lincoln with his first vice president and a number of other powerful politicians in Washington. There is a reason Maine's motto is, I lead. And there is a reason for the old saying, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. Now, way before Maine broke away from Massachusetts to become a state in 1820, people of color fished and farmed, sailed and labored on the rocky shores of the most northeastern part of the United States. The first Black person recorded to set foot in what is now Maine was Matthew da Costa, an interpreter for French explorers Pierre Dugas and Samuel de Champlain, the man for whom Lake Champlain is named. They were part of an exploring party that set up camp on St. Croix Island more than a decade before the Pilgrims arrived at Plymouth Rock. Da Costa is believed to have been fluent in Dutch, English, French, Portuguese, Mi'kmaq, and Pigeon Basque, and is known to have been sought by both the English and the Dutch to help in their contacts with native peoples in North America. Then there's the 1672 court document that describes, quote, Anthony, a black man, unquote. Anthony was Dr. Antonios Lamy and may have been Maine's first doctor. Don't get me wrong. Africans and their descendants have never been a big portion of Maine's population. In 1753, a Portland newspaper, The Transcript, reported there were 21 slaves in the area of Maine's largest city. By 1764, the newspaper said the number of blacks in Portland had increased to 44, while there were 322 blacks living in the territory of Maine. Today, when we think about major working seaports in Maine, usually only a few cities and towns come to mind. But in the 1800s, Bangor, Brewer, Searsport, Belfast, Kittery, York, Camden, Augusta, Hollowell, and Gardner also had major working waterfronts, along with almost every other town or city that touched upon the sea. How big? The 1850 federal census shows black seamen living in not only Eastport, but other Washington County communities such as Calais, Perry, Machias, Steuben, Dennisville, Lubeck, Addison, Amesbury, Baileyville, Bering, Beddington, Cherryfield, Columbia, Cutler, Columbia Falls, East Machias, Machiasport, Marion, Machias, Millbridge, Northfield, Pembroke, Princeton, Robinson, Steuben, Wesley, Alexander, and Jonesboro. I said Steuben twice. Apologize for that. In Hancock County, Blue Hill, Brooklyn, yes, Maine does have a Brooklyn, Bucksport, Castine, Cranberry Isle, Deer Isle, Estabrook, Ellsworth, Franklin, Gouldsboro, Hancock, Surrey, Vinyl Haven, Wetmore Isle, and Bar Harbor all had black residents. Waldo County, communities where blacks lived included Belfast, Belmont, Burnham, Frankfort, Islesboro, Jackson, Liberty, Lincolnville, Morrow, Monroe, Prospect, Searsport, Stockton, Swansville, Troy, Unity, and Waldo Plantation. And I haven't even begun talking about some of the big seaports, Portland, Brunswick, Bath, Damariscotta, Booth Bay, Wiscasset, and as the King of Siam would say, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now I'm a Maine native, and there are a number of those communities that I had never heard of before, so don't be worried if they were new to you. Again, it's hard to divorce ourselves from today, but in an era that had very few roads, the sea was the mode of transportation. If you were in Portland and wanted to go to Augusta or Bangor, you went by boat. A resident of Bath could easily go to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, but have a hard time getting to Lebanon, Maine. And it was the sea that allowed black folks to move to Maine. Wilson Crawford was born in Louisiana in 1815. More likely than not, he was born a slave. Wilson Crawford went to sea, and on a voyage to Nova Scotia, met and married his wife, Margaret. The two arrived at Eastport in early 1850. We know that because the 1850 federal census lists Wilson as working in Eastport as a barber. 10 years later, Wilson Crawford was running a hotel in Eastport, and had at least 11 others working for him. Four of those employed by Wilson were listed as Black. Seven others were called mulattoes. All were listed as servants. The census also showed five whites were staying at the hotel, including a merchant, a liquor dealer, a hat maker, and 13-year-old James O'Brien, who was working as a store boy. There are no records that tell us exactly which hotel Crawford was at. There were several in the city at that time, including Maybe's and the Quaddy, but they and most of downtown Eastport were destroyed by fire on October 22, 1864. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the location, was the easternmost part of this nation and a seaport. Only two of the 17 people listed at the hotel were born in the United States. Wilson Crawford, the hotel keeper, was from Louisiana. And one of the servants, 13-year-old Lavinia Hawkins, was born in Maine. The others came from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and two were from Ireland. In the 1850 census, there were 102 Black men in Maine listed as mariners, another 42 as sailors, four as seamen. I've never been able to figure out the difference between mariner, sailor, and seaman, but I'm sure there is. There were six listed as fishermen, and one each as boatman, river boatman, and lobsterman. Other occupations listed of men who worked either on or with ships included steward or waiter, cook, baker, victualler, machinist, blacksmith, shipwright, whitewasher, carpenter, cooper, and waterman. These men were born not only in Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, but came from southern states such as Florida, Georgia, South and North Carolina, Virginia, and the District of Columbia, among other places. They came from New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, the British Isles, England, France, Portugal. They came from Cuba, Puerto Rico, Jamaica, Bermuda, the West Indies, Haiti, and Santa Cruz. They came from Cape Verde, South America, and Africa. I don't know if you notice, but these destinations all have one thing in common. They all are on the sea. And if you're wondering about Eastport as a viable city, in 1850, Eastport had a population of 4,125. By 1900, the population was 5,311. In the census of 2020, just 2 years ago, Eastport had shrunk in size to less than a fourth of what it was in its heyday. By the way, Crawford was not the only Black man to run a hotel in Maine. In 1869, Cornelius Harris built a summer hotel at Prince's Point, which is 3 miles from Yarmouth, and he named it the Gem of the Bay. That hotel was destroyed by fire in October 1900. Harris was born in Nova Scotia, was chief steward on a vessel, which is how he got to Maine, and lived in Portland since the early 1860s. He served with the United States Colored Troops during the Civil War and died in Portland in 1920. Now, not all Blacks showed up in Maine on their own volition. When the Reverend James Lyon left Nova Scotia and moved to Machias, Maine in 1771, he brought with him his slave, London. According to the custom of the day, London's last name was the same as his owner, Lyon. The boy who would have been 11 or 12 years old when he lived in Nova Scotia, had been taken away from his family and given to the Reverend Lyon as a gift. Records show that London served several short-term enlistments during the Revolutionary War and fought in the Battle of the Margarita in 1775 off the coast of Machias. He was in his teens during this time, and he later used his bounty and wages that he had earned for his military service to purchase his freedom from Reverend Lyon. Now a free man, London also changed his name from Lyon to Attis. That could be pronounced Attis, I don't know. Some believe he chose the name Attis as a tribute to Crispus Attucks, a Black man who was the first to die in Boston in the battle that began the Revolutionary War. There's also a question as to who decided how to spell his last name, since London was illiterate. There were several spellings, but it was clearly important to London and his family that his name be spelled with a U. Eunice Foss was from a well-known white family in Machias. She and London had their first two children before they got married. This may have been because there was a law making interracial marriages illegal. Or it could have been because they wanted to get married. They wanted to wait to get married until London made enough money to pay the Reverend Lyon any other expenses he had made. He had owned his old master. Whatever. After their second child was born in 1789, Eunice was brought up on charges of fornication and fined 6 shillings for her crime. There are no records that she was charged with the same crime for their first child. And by the time she was convicted and fined, the Addis family had grown to 3 children. London and Eunice eventually married in 1791 and wound up with 11 children in all. One could have said, wow, that's enough to start a town. And so they did. The community of Addisville was a neighborhood in Machias and grew into a good-sized biracial community that had its own school. Abigail Japan was the daughter of a slave, Jacob, who with his wife and children were taken to Annapolis, Nova Scotia by their owner, a Dr. Bain, sometime during the Revolutionary War. Abigail was born in Annapolis, Nova Scotia, and later said she arrived in Portland about 1803 when she was about 18 years old. She served as a servant in the family of a general brewery, as she called him. This general brewery was evidently a man of means, as Abigail was always fond of telling of the many dishes of silver and gold that she used to polish when she was with that family. When the general left Portland for England, he left Abigail behind. She said Portland was just a mere village when she first arrived in Maine's largest city. She described the houses as very few and small, painted red with small windows. And Abigail remembered the fort on Fort Allen Park when soldiers were stationed there. Affectionately known as Aunt Abby, Abigail Japan worked as a servant for several prominent Portland families, including that of Sheriff J.C. Baker and Mayor John Neal, among others. Politically, she was a Republican and would proudly turn out for every political parade in the city. Abigail Japan died in Portland in 1892, at the age of 106. Her story is known because of a beautiful obituary that was printed in the Portland newspapers at the time of her death. In the 1850 census of Bristol, Maine, Richard McClary is listed as being born in Maine in 1798. He's also listed as not working, but is the head of the household of nine people. His wife has apparently died, but also living with Richard is 50-year-old Charles McClary, apparently Richard's brother. What makes this interesting is that a Richard McClary is listed in Bristol, Maine in 1800 as a slave. Four other slaves are in his house, which means this Richard McClary probably is the father of the Richard and Charles who were in the 1850 census. By the way, the 1820 census lists Richard McClary as head of family of 10 slaves in Bristol, Maine. 10 years later, the McClary family has seven people listed, all of them called, quote, free colored persons, unquote. Alexander Bush and his wife, Louisa Franklin, were both born in Nova Scotia, where they were married in 1848. They moved to the United States shortly after Louisa gave birth to their second son, landing in Perry, Maine in 1850, just in time to be counted in the census. Alexander worked as a laborer in Perry until he had amassed enough money to buy a farm about 8 miles away in Robinston. There, Alexander and Louisa raised their nine children, seven boys and two girls. Their second oldest, James, stayed on the farm, but did marry a Canadian girl, Annie Griffin. They had five children and named one of their four sons after James's father, Alexander. When the young Alexander died in 1956, his obituary in the Bangor Daily News noted that he was a veterinarian and was the, quote, last of the only Negro family in the area, end quote. Tobias Hill was born in Georgetown, Maine in 1743, the son of Sandusky and Margaret Hill. It's not known where either of his parents came from, but Tobias, we also call him Toby, became a fixture in Brunswick history. Tobias was one of several Black men who owned farms along Merrymeeting Bay. He was known as the Great Butcher of Hogs and was called in by a number of farmers in the area to slaughter their hogs. But he was bitten by one hog he had killed, and it resulted in lockjaw. Toby died a few days later. But while he was alive, Toby also sold bayberry fallow to households in Brunswick. At that time, nearly every housekeeper made her own candles and added bayberry tallow to the beef and mutton tallow to harden the candles and prevent them from melting down in warm weather. Tobias Hill is remembered today because a section of the old main road between Brunswick and Bath is called Toby's Turnpike. That's the section of the road that runs from Cook's Corner in Brunswick to the New Meadows Graveyard alongside what used to be the Brunswick Naval State Air Station. It turns out that Toby's Turnpike follows the bridle path Tobias Hill cut through the woods so he could go to the New Meadows Church. Tobias was married twice. The children from his first wife are the progenitors of the Hill family that continue to live in the Bath, Brunswick area. In 1808, he married Jenny DeShell, who was a slave when she first came to Maine from her native Virginia. Their son of Tobias and Jenny, began the Hill family that called Gardner home. Narcissus Mathias sailed up the Penobscot River to Bangor in 1834. He was a native of Cape Verde, a 10 island archipelago off the coast of Senegal. And at the time of his arrival in Bangor, was 11 years old. Not unusual that boys that age would work as cabin boys aboard ship. At one time, Matthias had 7 wagons engaged in trucking and the transfer of luggage around Bangor. He was the first man to deliver ice to people's homes and the first to deliver express packages to house. In other words, Narcissus Matthias created FedEx and UPS, and he did it before 1862. He also served the city of Bangor as a firefighter and was sexton of the Hammond Street Church. In 1862, Matthias purchased the Portuguese brig Jovem Arthur, which had been wrecked in the Penobscot River, thinking he could have it repaired. Unfortunately, he underestimated the cost and had to abandon his plan to return home to Cape Verde on his own ship. But just 8 years later, Matthias, his wife, and 2 of their 5 children left Bangor and moved to Cape Verde. On the island of St. Antoine, Matthias bought a plantation and raised coffee and other crops. He had lived in Bangor for only 36 years, but he returned to Cape Verde with enough money to live a life of leisure, and he left behind a legacy. One son, Fred, stayed in Bangor and had a trucking and furniture moving business. He also followed in his father's footsteps and became a fireman in Bangor, serving for 36 years. Fred's nephew, the grandson of the man from Cape Verde, became the first Black to graduate from the University of Maine at Orono. Also named Frederick Matthias, he majored in civil engineering before having a long career in city government in Philadelphia. I think it gives you an idea of Blacks in Maine, which they say is the whitest state in the nation. I happen to disagree with that. Because once they're here, they become, Black folks become invisible. My family, for example, that I can trace has been here since at least, well, they got married in 1783 in Cumberland County, in a place called New Gloucester. But I don't know where either one of them come from. So I could be the 9th generation or the 10th, but I do know that I'm the 8th. I'd be more than willing to take any questions there might be.
Thank you, Bob. We do have a couple questions from the audience. Do you have any more information on the precise current day location of Addisville? And do you know, is there any connection to the town of Addison?
There is no connection to Addison, but it is, Addisville was in Machias. And there's an area there, it had its own school. And it's like, But there's also a town in Warren that was named for Black folks.
Peterborough,
thank you. So, and again, it's part of the town of Warren, although you can still see it. And as far as Addisville, I'm not sure.
Someone else is mentioning the Peters family and their history in Warren, that they recently heard Kate McMahon speak on that topic, as well as the role of Maine shipbuilders in the slave trade. Has the work and the research that Kate McMahon has done on those topics, has that informed the work you've done, or vice versa? Do you guys collaborate on research on this topic at all?
It has not. I haven't gone into his work. I'm letting him work on his own, and I will be more than happy to folded into mine later on. There are other people also working on various things around the state that I will be looking at. The Peters family is one of the largest families around, and there's more than one name besides Peters. They have relatives called Oldie or Oney. I'm not sure which, maybe both. And there are a couple of other families that are connected to the Peters family that lived in either Warren or Thomaston.
Do you have any information about slavery in Kennebunk?
In where?
In Kennebunk.
Kennebunk. No, I don't. There is a marvelous book about slavery in Kittery.
Patricia Wall, right?
Right. She has identified identified by name about 500 Blacks that were slaves in that area, because Kittery, in case those that don't know, the Portsmouth Naval Yard is actually in Kittery. So all of the bringing in of slaves seemed to be the Kittery Portsmouth area. And so that's where a lot of them were landed. That probably also had a lot to do with the Pepperell family, which was one of the major slave owners and one of the big industrialists of that time.
You talked about a lot of different families this evening. Do you know a lot of these people that you talked about? Did they have families that stayed in Maine? Like, did they have descendants in Maine still?
As I made mention about one, and I have to go back to find out. Well, let's put it this way. The Matthias moved down to Pennsylvania and have gone other places since then. The Bush family that I made mention of, Alexander Bush, as his obituary said, was the last of his family in Maine. Nobody left. A lot of Maine families, Black families, moved out for a number of reasons. Mostly when steam came in, and what I mean by that is when steamships and iron ships replaced wooden sailing ships, all of a sudden the seaports in Maine weren't as productive or as important as others, just like, well, Boston, but even further south, New York, Newark, New Jersey, and even further south. So that was kind of like the end of Maine's big splurge in shipbuilding and everything. So they left to go, they left looking for jobs. A lot of Black families moved to Boston or to Rhode Island, and especially the sailors went with wherever the ships were going. You also find not a lot, that might be the wrong word to use, but a number of Black families became white through intermarriage with especially the white women. And their families are still living in Maine today. I have some who are part of my family that are listed in the census as white. Mm-hmm.
Can you speak about the history of Black churches in Maine and their contributions to the leadership in the larger community.
The Black churches?
Correct.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly.
Yes.
There really haven't been that many. And it's because of a paucity of population among Blacks. I mean, in Portland, in 1828, 1830, we started with the Abyssinian Church, which is currently in the process of being restored. It's the third oldest African-American meeting house that's still standing in the country. So that is being, like I said, being restored. There also was a Black Methodist church, AME church, that was only a block or two away from the Abyssinian. That started around 1850. It lasted until about 1890. In 1891, a African Methodist Episcopal Zion church took the place of the AME church. And that the replacement is now known as Green Memorial AME Zion, which is up on Sheridan Street on Munjoy Hill. There have been a couple of Baptist churches in Portland. I really don't know of any other Black churches in the state. However, I would not be shocked if somebody said that there was one in Addisville or in Peterborough, because I don't believe there was I'm sure that there was not a Black church in Bangor, but most Blacks in Bangor went to the same church.
Right. Black people coming to Maine from Nova Scotia, were they free people or were they enslaved people?
It's according to when they came. Mm-hmm. One of the things you have to understand is during the Revolutionary War, England offered any slave, Black slave, freedom if they fought for England. And a number did, over 5,000. And after England lost, it took those Black former slaves, and most of them wound up in Nova Scotia. That's where England dropped them off. So they were no longer slaves. But as I made mention earlier, Londonatus came from Nova Scotia as a slave, but he came here in the 1700s. So One of the things I ought to explain, my background. As I said, I am at least eighth generation Mainer. And my family, I have no clue as to where they came from. I do know that a couple were married in New Gloucester in December of 1783. As far as I'm concerned, and I say that because the names changed, 1790 census there, which is the first census, there's a person in Cumberland County called Black Boston or Boston Black. I'm not, you know, you're not sure which, what they did in the census. In 1800, in the same location, there's a Black person named Mauston Ruby. Is that Boston? And his, I'm not, his name is not Ruby. I'm sorry. It's Marston Reuben.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where he is located in New Gloucester, in the area where New Gloucester, Gray, Durham, and Auburn are all within, I would say within a mile of each other. He has this couple, are there at least five or six children born by the last name of Ruby. I think that's the same people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is Sophia Ruby, who is my four-time great-grandmother. And that was how I began my search for my roots. And it led me into trying to figure out who was who and where was where and what was what.
And like, how many, just out of curiosity, you know, I mean, we see a lot of folks at Maine Historical Society that are doing genealogical research, and it can be quite an undertaking. How many years, I mean, has it taken you, and I'm sure it's like an ongoing project, but to pull all that information about your family together?
I'm still looking, and I started in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
That year, my oldest son asked me if he had any relatives, any cousin. And I laughed. My children were, I ended up leaving Portland after high school and going off to college. And I ended up at the University of Kansas. My children, I married and my children were all born in the Midwest, where my father's family is from.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew my father's family, and my father's siblings had very few children, with the exception of one. But I grew up here. I was born and grew up here, and I knew all of my grandmother's cousins. I didn't know they were cousins and aunts and uncles at the time.
Right.
But one of the things about my research is, told me who everybody that was coming into the house all the time was. And I was related to like everybody. So this was how it started. Since then, of course, I have expanded. When the pandemic started, I decided, as a project being limited to my household,
mm-hmm.
that I would do genealogical research on every Black listed in the 1850 census. I basically have completed that, but I've had to enlarge it to every Black in Maine in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Which includes people like London Atis, who was from 1740s. And so, yeah.
That's a huge project.
Definitely. But an enjoyable one.
Good. Good. And an important one too.
It's nice learning about all of these people and seeing exactly what's going on. I don't know. I thoroughly enjoy it.
Someone is mentioning that New York and Boston became places where free people of color, where they migrated to after emancipation. And they're wondering, was that also the case for Maine? Was Maine a place that people were migrating to from?
I talked about how powerful Maine was. Maine had 34 generals in the Civil War. Two of those, by the way, were generals for the Confederacy. Maine had more generals in the Confederate Army than Texas did.
Wow.
Texas only had one. We had two.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So when these and when these generals came home, a lot of them brought Blacks with them. That's how the Kemp family, George Kemp in the Leeds area, he came up with one of the generals. And you'll find others came up at various times. So yes, there was another wave of influx of blacks. Another one, I tell people in my classes, if you stop to think why blacks come to Maine, right now might be a little different, but why they came to Maine was because of jobs. Why they left Maine was because of jobs. And so when Maine had jobs, blacks came. This even includes during the Second World War when we had two shipyards here in Portland. There was an influx of blacks from whoever needed a job, they came for the shipyard. But right after the war ended, the shipyards closed, there were no jobs. So a lot of those blacks left to go where the jobs were. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we talk about blacks, but whites are the same thing.
Yeah.
People just followed jobs. So this is, and this has happened all along. Now you find two other things that are happening that have to be put into that complex that we're talking about. We're getting now African immigrants who are coming to Maine because of how safe they feel here. And especially true, I know a lot of the Somalis that live in Lewiston came here from Atlanta area, mm-hmm. where they felt very unsafe. Mm. And so they came here because of safety. So there are other reasons. You find, again, some blacks that are moving here after they retire are coming here just for safety and for what everybody else enjoys about Maine.
Sure.
So it's not unusual why people come here.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
Yeah, we got a lot more questions. Someone's mentioning the Reuben Ruby family, how that's an important Maine and national history. Could you tell us more about Reuben and his family?
Surely. I made mention of Black Boston or Boston Reuben. Well, one of the sons of Boston Ruby was Reuben Ruby. His sister, by the way, was Sophia, who was my four-time great-grandmother. So Reuben is actually my uncle or four-time great-uncle. And Reuben Ruby was very strong in the anti-slavery and the abolitionist movement. He traveled quite a bit. And following him, especially, you realize that people in those days traveled a lot more than I expected. He was always just jumping down to Boston or to Providence or to New York, Philadelphia, on boat. Went by ship on the sea, but he ended up being one of the officers in several different abolitionist groups, national groups, where he was vice president or one of the regional vice presidents. So he was very involved. He was the only Black I've been able to find who was in Hallowell when the Maine Abolitionist Society was formed. He signed in. He was also very involved in politics in the state and in the city of Portland. He had a number of children. Three men ended up being very big politically. One was William Wilberforce Ruby, Reuben's son, who was a fireman in Portland and is credited with giving the first alarm for the Great Fire of July 4th, 1866. Another, by the way, William also had a restaurant and was one of the things that I've noticed, by the way, is Black men in the 1800s that I've noticed, they had two skills. They learned that they knew how to cook and they knew how to wait on tables. And what that did was that you were could get a job on land as a cook or a waiter, mm-hmm. or you could work aboard ship as cook or steward. Steward is a waiter. Mm-hmm. So it was very well way to make money and just to keep employed. Mm-hmm. There was the second son I wanted to talk about was George Thompson Ruby. George, by the way, both William Wilberforce Ruby and George Thompson Ruby, the first and middle names, are white British abolitionists. So Reuben was quite familiar with what was going on, mm-hmm. as most people were. So we have George Thompson Ruby, among other things, ended up being a state senator in Texas during Reconstruction, and then later became a, he owned a newspaper in New Orleans right after he left Texas. So he died in 1882 at the age of just 42 years old. So he was a young man when he died. The third member of that family, or third son of Reuben, was Horatio. And Horatio also lived in Texas for a while. He joined the Navy at a very old age. And I think he was in his 40s when he joined. And what he did, he was a cook aboard a ship that was going to Columbia, a U.S. Navy ship that was going to Columbia to try to find the place to build a canal to connect the Atlantic and Pacific oceans. And of course, as we all know now, the head of that, the Commodore that headed up that task force, came back and reported to the nation that Columbia was not a good place. And the next place they tried, of course, was Panama. But he then, Horatio, after that, after he came back from that, he then signed on as cook with a Maine company, the Arado Company. And they had a task force, a naval task force, go to back down to Columbia looking for gold. They apparently didn't find it, but it was interesting. So, yeah, Reuben Ruby was very interesting man. He ended up working for the U.S. Customs House, which is a political thing. Mm-hmm. And with that political thing, he apparently still had some power even as he got older. And the reason I say that is after George Thompson Ruby, his son, died, the widow, and George died in New Orleans. His widow goes back to Washington, D.C., where she's from, and she gets a job with the U.S. government printing office. And I found a report that said that she was hired through the Portland, Maine Customs House.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So and Reuben by that time was already dead. There still is some political.
Interesting.
Quite interesting.
Now, a number of people are asking about specific communities or families. I think they're interested to hear more about your research, and we're running a little short on time, so I'm going to ask you two more questions. First, someone's wondering if by any chance, you know, all this research you've done, are you perhaps working on a book? And the second question is, if people want to know, like, more, if they've got, you know, questions about specific places, people, is there a way that they can reach out to you or get in touch with you beyond this program, maybe through Ollie or someplace else?
They can get in touch with me through the Maine Historical Society. And I'd be more than happy to answer any other questions they might have. And I am planning on, now that we're hopefully going back to classes and everything, I'm planning on doing my Black History of Maine course again with Ollie in the winter. It's a 6-week course in January and February, hoping that none of the days are, it's only one day a week, and we hope that, of course, it doesn't get snowed out.
Right. And that you'll be able to, so is that going to be in person? Is that your hope?
I'm hoping to be in person, but if not, I'm thinking about doing it on Zoom.
Excellent. So any books or articles or anything in the works?
Articles, yes.
Okay.
I realize as a journalist and everything, I am a writer of news articles, especially from tabloid type newspapers. I'm not one to do 75,000 words. And so I thought about it and I realized that I would not be the good person on that. So.
Understood. I'm going to put my email in the chat, folks, which is K Newman, KNEUMANN at mainhistory.org. So if we didn't get to your question this evening and you've got a burning question for Bob, I'm happy to forward them to him if you reach out to me, and we'll do the best that we can. Of course, if you're doing research on a family or a community yourself, Maine Historical Society is a great place to start. If you visit our website, mainhistory.org, you can make an appointment to do research in our library. Our research library is open right now, but it's open by appointment only. So check out our website to learn more information. You can also start your research from home if you visit our online database, Maine Memory Network at mainmemory.net. And of course, visit mainhistory.org for more information on how you can become a member, upcoming programs, and of course to find the recording of this program. But thank you all so much for being here and for your thoughtful questions and engaging discussion. And thank you, Bob, for sharing your expertise and your knowledge and just for being here with us this evening for a great talk and a great discussion on this topic.